I have been a longtime fan of Woody Allen's work, from his early stand-up years to his many appearances on television to the beginnings of his movie career with movies like Take the Money and Run and Sleeper and Bananas, and then on to his masterpiece Annie Hall and Manhattan. And even through the fallow years of the mid-90s through 2004 or so, where he wasn't really making great stuff, I still kind of checked him out every once in a while. Didn't go see every one of his movies, but checked him out. And then, of course, in recent years, in the last decade, he's had a real resurgence and I think done some of the best stuff he's done in quite a long time. So as a fan of Woody Allen, I was excited to hear that there was a new biography of him, the first one to be done, to my knowledge, in at least a decade, which means it has to cover some rather controversial subject matter, and it does. And it's written by my guest today, David Evanier. The book is simply called Woody, the Biography. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Paul.
Nice to have you on here. Did he cooperate?
Yes, he did. This is not an authorized book, but, you know, I got to Woody by ringing his doorbell and left a letter, and I heard from him the next day, and we had a back and forth email correspondence, and finally, near the end, we sat down together for an hour and a half.
He was reluctant at the beginning, and it's because of the controversies that have come back about his relationship with Mia Farrow, etc., in the last few years, and we're going to delve into that. But how did you overcome his initial lack of trust?
It was a gradual process. You know, Woody has this kind of a psychic personality. He's able to figure out people. I think it's kind of an instinctive ability. And I think he came to understand that I was friendly, sympathetic, and objective, because he doesn't really want sentimentality. He wants the truth, and I think he got the idea that that's what I was pursuing.
Now, you're a longtime fan, as I am, but you've met the man in person. What's the difference between Woody Allen, the screen character? I mean, he's essentially played himself in most of his movies, and the Woody Allen in real life.
It's totally different. Woody is a tough personality. He's not a schlemiel. He's very strong, assertive, has a great work ethic. He works long hours every day. He never takes a break. He's very determined and. He's not fuzzy warm by any means. He's a craftsman. He's a guy who just sits down and does the work every day, and he has been doing that now for well over 60 years. His real personality is very, very different. He created this character of the schlemiel, out of aspects of himself. And he was able to somehow stand outside, objectively stand apart, and see that what would be funny, what would work. And that's what he does. He has said that, you know, he's never told a joke to his therapist. He is essentially a craftsman.
Many people don't know that there was a Woody Allen stand-up comic era.
It was a great era. He was extremely successful. He was frightened out of his wits. Before performances, he would throw up. He would bite his nails. He would tremble. It took him 2 years to become a successful stand-up comic. Woody's had great mentors. He had a manager, Jack Rollins, who gave everything to Woody, and stayed backstage with him. Pushed him on stage. Woody was the most frightened person in the world when he started as a stand-up. He was a very successful comedy writer, making $1,700 a week, but he didn't like comedy writing, and he wanted to do something. He's always wanted to keep moving, and Jack Rollins persuaded him that if he would read the material he wrote himself, he would be far more successful. So for 2 years, he was terrified of going on stage, and gradually he became one of the most effective comedians probably in the history of American show business.
That's so interesting because for anybody who's listened to the famous double album of his stand-up years, which collects many of his stand-up routines, he couldn't sound more confident.
Well, he came to love it. I mean, he realized at first that he would get up on stage and read the material, and the audience didn't get it.
You mean he would hold a piece of paper and just read?
He would read. He would just read it. And then he realized they want a person up there, a character. And he's highly intelligent, and he finally figured out that he had to like the audience. He had to like being up there. He would stand there with the microphone and the cord, and people were afraid he was going to strangle himself because the cord he would tie the cord around his neck.
Oh.
He was so nervous. And he finally figured out he had to enjoy himself if the audience was going to enjoy it.
Now, what's interesting for everybody who has heard those routines is they were not typical of what comedy sounded like. I mean, until this era in which he emerged, most comedians of that era were borscht belt kind of put on a tux, sweat, tell jokes about the wife, and they were mostly ba-dum-bum, 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 set up, punchline. That's not what he did. He was very different, wasn't he?
Yes, he was very he was very vulnerable. He was the little man. He was the guy who didn't get the girl. He was the guy who had all the fears, and he was funny looking. He looked like a messenger boy, and he did not talk down to the audience. He acted like he was what he was. Well, I mean, he was working really out of his own terror and his own fear. And, of course, there were all these other great comics emerging at that point. Lenny Bruce, Mort Saul, who Woody idolized, Shelley Berman. And Woody saw these comics and thought, you know, well, I can do that. But he did it in a very different way because even though he didn't do shtick, as you say, like the Catskill performers, but he did a character. And the character was a character that everyone could identify with, and it came along at a time in the 60s when a lot of things were being questioned, including male masculinity and how we judge people. And so Woody came on very vulnerable, very as if he couldn't score with girls. He constantly talked about his own problems, or even though they were not necessarily really his, but he created a character, as I said, that came out of himself, but which really was like every man. It was like, you know, in the I guess Chaplin's Little Tramp, there was the little man against the world, and Woody was the latest personification of that. But he was the funniest.
After his stand-up success, or during his stand-up success, he started to do a lot of TV. Later, he did some very famous interviews with Dick Cavett. But he appeared on all sorts of shows, and even produced some of his own prime time shows, didn't he?
Yes, he produced a few. He eventually walked away from that. He's basically walked away from, you know, he walked away from being a stand-up comic. He walked away from TV writing. He walked away from just about everything to keep moving when he got tired of it and wanted to keep evolving, which is what he's done.
I'm talking with David Evanier, the author of a new biography of Woody Allen. We've been talking about his TV career and his stand-up career, but let's get into his movies. The man is about to turn 80 years old and is working on at least one, maybe two, maybe three more movies. You never know. And he's turned out one pretty much every year for about a half a century.
46 movies for 46 years.
Wow.
And sometimes he's made two at the same time.
Now, here's the amazing thing about this. About half of those movies haven't been that good.
Exactly.
So, you know, if you told me, okay, you're going to write a book about a guy who made 23 not-so-good movies, people would go, how did anybody have a career like that? Well, the answer is you balance it out with the great movies he's done, and you end up with a list that includes my all-time Woody Allen favorite, Annie Hall. Now, in reading your book, I found something fascinating about this movie, that it originally did not have a lot of Annie Hall in it.
That's right. That movie essentially began as a series of sketches, and Woody turned to a film editor named Ralph Rosenblum, who looked at what Woody had done, and he saw a bunch of sketches, and he noticed that there was something else in that film, which was the relationship with Annie Hall. But that relationship was a very small part of the movie. So he put it together. He told Woody, this is what the film was about, this is what audiences responded to. And Woody didn't know this. He simply did not know this. And he's always been able to take criticism very well. And that movie became a romance, really also based on his own life. And it evolved. And he moved from the jokey movies, which he originally had been writing, which were wonderful, like Take the Money and Run and Sleeper and Bananas. But he moved toward this deeper character portrayal, which began with Annie Hall, and which also he plucked out of his own experience and his own life, his experience with Diane Keaton.
And does he at that point then have to go back and reshoot things and write new things and add them to make the movie whole?
Absolutely, he does this all the time. He is the most flexible of people. Ego never gets in the way with Woody. He wants it to work. He does three or four versions of a draft, and he'll turn to the cast, to the film editor, and say, "You pick the best one."
Now, you've got a story in the book about the ending of the movie because Woody did not know how to end it. And was it Ralph Rosenblum who put together the montage?
Yes. He thought of using Diane Keaton singing Seems Like Old Times.
Yep.
And having that montage of all the scenes from their romance. That was Ralph Rosenblum's idea. And by the way, Manhattan was constructed the same way. Manhattan originally was called anhedonia, which means the inability to enjoy life. Woody actually thought that was going to be a meditation about his inability to enjoy things. And, it eventually became the romance with Tracy. But, these things evolved in such a way that he frequently didn't know himself.
Anhedonia was the original name of Manhattan. I always thought it was Annie Hall.
Manhattan's original title was Anhedonia.
Oh.
And when he gave that title to the fellows at United Artists, they winced. He knew that gave them pain because they figured this was the end. but all these guys are like the heads of United Artists, Arthur Krim, and before that, as I said, Jack Rollins, his manager. These were guys who loved Woody, saw his potential, and gave him a blank check. He's had total artistic control from the very beginning. After his disastrous experience with What's New Pussycat and Casino Royale, where the decisions were made by everybody else, he decided he must have final cut, he must have final, total artistic control. And he worked that out. He worked that out in such a way that no other performer, no other actor has ever done.
How far does that creative control go? Is he in
it goes
charge?
Goes all the way.
Is he even in charge of the marketing of his movies and the trailers?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. He doesn't allow commercials to be used in certain cities. I mean, he's got all kinds of prohibitions, and he wants totally Woody Allen, again, in terms of what he really is like as opposed to his image, is a very tough guy. At the same time, he's a moral guy, and he's always been respected by the people he's worked with because of the fact that he's been honest and loyal to them.
You mentioned Manhattan. We've got to go back to that because that was a movie that started a theme that would follow him for most of the rest of his movies and into his real life as well, and that is the older man, younger woman theme. In that movie, Woody's character has a relationship with a girl who's still in high school. I think she's 16 or 17 years old, played by Marielle Hemingway. which I understand is based on a real relationship that Woody did have in real life.
Yes, it was a relationship with a young woman named Stacy Nelkin. There's an important point about this, though, about these relationships that he depicts. These are relationships in which they're not really essentially sexual in feeling. Woody has a feeling for the freshness and honesty of young people. And as some critics have noted, in these films, it's not so much a sexual pull that you feel. You feel the relationship. I mean, you feel that in movies like Crimes and Misdemeanors with his young niece. It's a subtle difference, and one that is there. If you really look at it closely.
But he even carries it forward in movies that he is not the star of. This year, he made a movie called An Irrational Man, which I thought was absolutely horrible.
I agree.
But in that, he's got Joaquin Phoenix, 41 years old, and Emma Stone, who's 26 years old. I mean, it's always 10, 15, maybe more years between the lead actor and the lead actress.
That's absolutely true. And yet, the implication of that is not what it seems. By the way, I agree with you totally about how terrible that movie is. And I say in the book that Woody has a cycle where he will do one wonderful film and two horrible ones. But, you know, it's his willingness, as he's always said, to fail in order to, you know, get to something else, to get to something better. And he does not care that the critics are negative about some of his movies. He really doesn't read his reviews. It's amazing. But he is willing to fail, and God knows he's failed with all those films that were lugubrious imitations of Ingmar Bergman. September, which United Artists let him make twice, and it still was terrible.
Yeah.
And, you know, Interiors, Shadows and Fog. These are dreadful, and yet suddenly he comes back with Husbands and Wives, and Mighty Aphrodite, and Hannah and Her Sisters, and Crimes and Misdemeanors, and scores of wonderful films.
And in recent years, of course, Midnight in Paris and Blue Jasmine, both of which were among the biggest hits in his career. But in the middle, you get things like To Rome with Love and Magic in the Moonlight. So
you hit it exactly right, and he's willing to do that. He has the freedom to do that. He has the freedom to lose sometimes. He feels that it's sort of like if you throw enough against the wall, some of it is going to stick.
I know a lot of people have probably said to him, you know, Woody, how about a movie every 2 years? Skip the bad years.
Well, that's just not his personality. He's a very impatient personality.
I'm Paul Harris, talking with David Evanier about his new book, Woody, the Biography. A biography, of course, about movie maker Woody Allen, who has a history of making movies with strong female characters in them. In fact, I think, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, David, but I think he probably has one of the best reputations in Hollywood for writing female characters, not just in the Diane Keaton and Mia Farrow years, but he won an Academy Award for Cate Blanchett a couple of years ago.
Yes, you know, he likes women, he loves women, and he definitely has learned, I think, from his wives. He's had very complex wives. His second wife, Louise Lasser, was really his soulmate. She was Mary Hartman in the early years, a very daffy, early wonderful TV series.
Yep.
She was really as good as Woody, and she would give him some of his best lines. And then he had the relationship with Diane Keaton. Earlier with Harlene Rosen, who was heard from in my book for the first time. Harlene Rosen majored in philosophy. Woody put her through college. So he's dealt with complex women, and he's very curious about them, and he and women are very grateful because they are cast in his films. You know, Woody doesn't care about age. He doesn't even care about an actor's recent history. He'll cast actors who haven't been around for a long time, like Andrew Dice Clay. He's interested in unique character, natural characters.
Now, it's shocking to me that Woody Allen even knew who Andrew Dice Clay was.
He probably didn't.
So
I think it was brought to his attention, I believe, when I spoke to his casting director, Julia Taylor.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, he spends a couple of minutes with an actor, and he knows. He knows instinctively. And his whole directing process is getting out of the way and letting the actor do what they can do best.
Now, wait a second. When you say he spends a couple of minutes with an actor and he knows, actors come in, and I'm sure that people still have to audition. I doubt that Cate Blanchett or Joaquin Phoenix have to audition. They just get cast. But other people, when they have to come in and be cast in maybe not the lead roles, but, you know, Julia Taylor wants to say, Woody, take a look at this person. He looks at them for 2 minutes and that's it? Yes or no?
Could be 3 or 4 minutes. It used to be no minutes. He used to just sit in the back and just make a decision on instinct. And Julia Taylor, over the years, because he was very shy with actors, he knew what it was like to audition, and he felt that it was painful for them, and he didn't want to subject them to it. He didn't realize, of course, they were dying to be in his films. Julia Taylor, but sometimes this process did not work out, and he had to recast later on because an actor did not work out.
So, oh, yeah?
Julia Taylor pleaded with him, Woody, you know, at least spend a couple of minutes, you know, with these actors. And he now does that.
And on the set, he gives them minimal instruction?
Very minimal instruction. John Ford, I believe it was, who said that casting is 80% of the directing process, the right casting. And Woody practices that.
I get the sense in reading your book that the hardest part of making a movie for Woody Allen is making a movie, that he loves being a writer, but even the fact that he doesn't interact with the people he's working with tells me, oh, that's just a pain. He just wants to get through it and get on to the next thing.
Yeah, his love is the writing. He loves the writing process. He's called it, writing is like flying. It's like a sensual experience. It's like a culmination. And even before he sits down to write, he imagines the entire movie. He imagines exactly what he's going to write, and he sits down and does it. And for him, that's the happiest process.
Does he care about a movie's commercial success?
Not at all. You know, this is the hardest thing to get to grasp, that Woody Allen does not care about anything but the quality of the movie and doing his best. It took me a long time to actually believe this, but I came to realize it was true.
Does he have high regard for any of his movies?
It varies, but I think he changes from time to time. I would say he has expressed that he likes The Purple Rose of Cairo. Let me see. Blue Jasmine, Match Point, and a couple of others. But he's highly, highly critical. This is one of the things about Woody Allen. His concern that he's never, in his own estimation, made a masterpiece. When I first wrote him, I told him that I thought that Zelig and Crimes and Misdemeanors were masterpieces, and he bristled. He bristled at the notion, I also think he has a considerable admiration, by the way, for Husbands and Wives, which he certainly should. But Woody is consumed with one thought, I think, and that is that he has not made a masterpiece in his own mind.
And obviously he couldn't have cared less about his Oscar for Best Picture for Annie Hall almost 40 years ago, or the many, many times he and the people who he's worked with have been nominated or won these awards, right?
He doesn't think anything of the awards. And as you know, on Academy Award nights, he is playing with his New Orleans jazz band every Monday night, and has only gone to the Academy Awards one time, and that was in honor of New York City after 9/11, where he gave a very funny, moving speech. He even did some stand-up. But it was in behalf of New York, in behalf of the city, and of the situation.
I want to talk to you about a couple of anomalies from his movie career, because he didn't write or direct them. I thought he was terrific in a movie directed by Martin Ritt called The Front.
Yes.
About blacklisted writers during the McCarthy era. And
yes.
I thought he did a good job as the voice of Z in the animated movie Ants. And even in Paul Mazursky's Scenes from a Mall, which wasn't a great movie, he and Bette Midler were pretty good.
And also most recently in Fading Gigolo, the John Turturro movie. He's wonderful in that.
Yes, he is. Has he wanted to do more of those things? How does he fit them into a schedule where he's always making his own movies?
He's always wanted to be cast more frequently in movies. That's a part of him that he really enjoys, and he grabs every opportunity.
Why did he do The Front?
The Front was a moral and political decision for him. His uncle, Abe Burrows, the comedy writer and playwright, had been a victim of the blacklist. And Woody wanted to do something to express his feeling about the Hollywood blacklist. And when Walter Bernstein, who was a victim of the blacklist, and Martin Ritt, who also was, came to him, he immediately said, "I'm going to do this."
And how did he get talked into doing an animated movie? If there's one thing I would think would be as un-Woody Allen as anything else, it would be making a cartoon.
If it's something new, if it's something he's never done before, he will grab it.
Of course, I say that, and then I realize he had animated scenes in Annie Hall.
That's right. And, you know, there was a lot of innovation in Annie Hall, including the animated scenes, and they were wonderful.
Yeah. Another anomaly I've got to ask you about is his movie Play It Again, Sam, which was originally a Broadway play, fairly successful enough for a Hollywood to say, hey, we'd like to make a movie out of that. But they would not let him direct it. He wrote it, he starred in it, but he did not direct it. Is that the only time that's happened in his career to one of his own projects?
That's the only time, and that was brought about by Peter Barrett. And Woody has never spoken to him again, Peter told me.
So why did a guy by the name of Herbert Ross get the assignment, and how did that work out?
Because Peter Barrett thought that Woody had a more wider appeal than he'd been able to achieve in films, and he thought that this director would have that wider commercial sense. And actually, the movie came out very well.
Yeah, I think it did too. In fact, people who watch it who don't know that Woody Allen didn't direct it could easily believe that he did.
Yes, and I think that Woody, it's one of Woody's finest plays.
Yeah, I agree. All right, David, now we have to get to the subject that comes up when people aren't talking about Woody Allen's movies or his stand-up career or his TV career or anything else, and that, of course, is the molestation charge that was filed against him back in 1992 by Dylan Farrow, one of the children of his then-girlfriend, Mia Farrow. You write about this extensively in the book. I'm curious, overall, how this whole saga affected your view of Woody Allen.
You know, I went into this book not knowing how I would feel about these matters. And as I came to investigate it, talk with the former sex crimes prosecutor, Linda Fairstein, and Dorothy Rabinowitz, who had written books about induced sexual memory, because that was a topic that was a matter of some hysteria in the 90s.
Yep.
And also examining the case very, very closely, examining Mia Farrow's behavior, including some very odd details, which I can go into with you at some length. For example, that there was a pattern of Mia making these accusations, and at the same time, when there was a tribute to Woody for the Golden Globes, there was supposed to be a film montage where she consented to be included in this tribute to him.
The implication being, if she hated him so much and thought that he had molested her daughter, why would she agree to do something that pays tribute to him?
Yes, but that was only one of many, many instances of this. She asked her therapist, "Should I marry Woody?" This was well after the accusations were being hurled. There were other, and also when she was hired for Manhattan Murder Mystery, and then the accusations, began. She still wanted to be in the film, and she called the costume designer. She wanted to know when her costumes would be ready. There was a strange disconnect there between, and also her disappointment when the Yale New Haven Clinic, which was the most important institution for examining sex abuse cases, exonerated Woody Allen after interviewing Dylan Farrow 9 times, interviewing many other participants. Mia was very distraught at the conclusion, rather than being, you would think, happy that Woody had been exonerated of the charges.
You know, I remember watching an interview he did with Steve Croft on 60 Minutes, roughly about the time that this was going on, in which he essentially said that Mia had called him and said, "You took my daughter," meaning Soon Yi, "now I'm going to take yours," meaning Dylan Farrow.
Yes, and, there were many other oddities like this. We're only touching on a few of them. There was a pattern to this that sounded more like vengeance than anything else.
What's the relationship like between the Farrow children and Woody? Is there any?
Well, that's one of the most interesting things. One of the children, Moses Farrow, has stated publicly that these events never took place, that he loves Woody, and that Woody was a good father, and that Mia was a very punishing kind of mother. So that relationship, Moses was someone who initially had said he hoped Woody would die, and has come around to loving Woody again, and that change in attitude from one of the children is a very significant fact.
Now, what about any kind of relationship between Woody's wife, Soon Yi? They've been married for, about 20 years now, something like that?
Almost 20 years. They've been together 22 years.
Okay. So does she have any relationship with Mia?
To my knowledge, that would be extremely unlikely,
yeah,
if not impossible. But, as I write in the book, Woody told me that his relationship with Soon Yi has been one of the miraculous and most wonderful events of his life.
Well, you go into a lot of detail in that, and a lot of detail and information from other people who knew him very well, and the portion of the book where you sit down and talk to him. By the way, what's that like to sit down and talk to him? Were you in a public place? Were you in his apartment?
I was in his screening room.
Was it just the two of you?
Just the two of us. Ginny, his assistant, introduced us. Woody had said we would get together for a half hour. He kept extending it. It was very warm, and I thought he was as curious about me as I was about him. He has that human responsiveness.
But he was not reluctant to talk about his movies, etc.
He wasn't reluctant to talk about anything.
Fascinating. Fascinating. And the book is wonderful. A real in-depth look at a man who has, as we said, had a career of nearly a half a century now, made some bad movies, made some great movies, and probably in the middle averaged out to one of America's finest filmmakers when you look back on it. Certainly a career unlike anybody else's. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes. And, when I said to John Simon, the critic, the question of Woody making a masterpiece, John Simon said, "Well, if you make 25 excellent films, isn't that kind of equivalent to a masterpiece?"
We'll end it there. The book is Woody, the Biography. And here's the biographer, David Evanier. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Paul. It's been a pleasure.